On the program today, sure, yes, the president signed a bunch of economic memos. What do you suppose do they actually mean? Also, what's your relationship with your money? Think about that for a second, would you? From American Public Media, this is Market Flags. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, the 10th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin this work week with business owners and accountants and economists and people who are working in this economy trying to figure out what exactly President Trump did to this economy this weekend. He signed some things, one executive order and three memoranda after negotiations on another economic support plan on Capitol Hill collapsed. That much you know. Whether the president can actually do most of what he did depends on who you talk to. So rather than engage in that particular back and forth, we'll focus today here on the thing he did that he can do, deferring collection of payroll taxes, specifically putting on hold the collection of taxes on the employee portion of Social Security taxes, 6.2% per paycheck, if you're curious. Starts September the 1st, ends at New Year's, only for people making less than about $100,000 a year. That much is what we know. Now, what's it going to mean? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget wades through complicated tax proposals and regulations all the time. But President Maya McGuinness says the White House's memorandum on deferring payroll tax obligations leaves her with...
?
Starting with this, what happens come January when employee payroll taxes that weren't collected come due?
Nobody knows how the repayment part will have to be structured. It's going to complicate the life of employers tremendously if they have to be responsible for making sure that money gets paid back.
And small business tax advisor Barbara Weltman says this payroll tax holiday could change.
So right now we're talking about deferral, meaning you don't pay now, you pay later.
The president has instructed the Treasury Secretary to explore options, including legislation, to forgive those payroll taxes altogether. Pete Eisberg at Payroll Processor ADP says it's going to be really complicated for employers to alter payroll tax collection mid-year for only some employees based on a salary threshold.
Programming changes of this magnitude normally require like 6 months to do. So obviously it can be done sort of on an emergency basis, but it may be problematic.
He says employers could be liable for not withholding enough tax and underpaying the Treasury. Randy Delwo owns a business that makes scientific instruments in Bend, Oregon. He talked to his 10 employees at a Zoom meeting this morning.
And the consensus among our employees is that everyone would rather not defer their payroll taxes. For one thing, they would need to save the money so that they'd have it available to pay back at the end of the year.
The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget estimates temporary payroll tax deferment could leave U.S. workers with as much as $100 billion of extra pay through December. But if a lot of businesses and employees follow the lead of Randy Delwo's company, the impact will be more muted. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Our regularly scheduled report on inflation comes out Wednesday morning. We'll get the July Consumer Price Index, how much prices have gone up or down, I suppose, as possible. With all the macroeconomic agita of the past couple of months, though, inflation has kind of gotten lost in the mix. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer for the CPI primer.
The Consumer Price Index measures how the cost of a sample shopping cart of staples changes over time. There's lots of stuff in the cart.
Almost everything that you could think of and that you buy.
Steve Cicchetti is an economist at Brandeis University.
Food, apparel.
Phones, appliances, but also services.
Insurance, transportation, if you actually go anywhere. Also energy, medical care, education, entertainment.
Cicchetti says the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, which compiles the CPI each month, collects price data from more than 25,000 businesses. Nationwide Insurance Chief Economist David Burson says it is a labor-intensive process.
Basically, they go to stores, whether it's electronically or in person, and write down prices, and they compare those prices to a month earlier.
The BLS surveys consumers every few years, asking what they're buying, and then updates the cart. The BLS also tries to adjust for price spikes, which can distort the overall picture. It releases something called the core CPI each month, which strips out volatile food and energy prices. Kathy Bosjancic, U.S. Chief Financial Economist at Oxford Economics, says the pandemic has pushed up the cost of things in high demand, like alcohol.
Alcoholic beverage inflation has increased from less than 1%. It was 0.9% in February, increased to 2.2% in June.
The CPI can affect your wallet. Your boss may use it to calculate your next raise to keep it above inflation. And Social Security cost of living adjustments are tied to the CPI. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, look, here's what's going on with the markets and the economy and whatever additional support plan Congress might or might not come up with. The markets believe, mostly because history has proven them right, that there is going to be another package, an actual package, legislation, not memoranda from the president. And because traders believe that, stocks keep going up, which, in the perverse way these things work, takes the pressure off Washington to actually make a deal because, hey, the markets are up. Everything must be fine. Even though 30 million people are getting some kind of unemployment help from the government. Details, numbers, you know the rest. We've reported before on this program about the challenges that malls have been dealing with the past number of years. Big anchor chains like Sears and JCPenney in trouble and closing stores. Straight to your doorstep, e-commerce, too. No need to even go to a mall, right? So with some irony comes the news today in the Wall Street Journal that Amazon, in desperate need of more square footage to get us the stuff that we're ordering, they are talking with Simon Properties, the biggest owner of shopping malls in this country, about turning some of those empty mall stores into Amazon fulfillment centers. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
Amazon just reported its best quarter ever. Malls, on the other hand, are in a bad way, partly because of Amazon. Sonia Lipinski is a retail analyst at Alex Partners.
Traffic in malls has been declining for quite some time. Specialty apparel, which dominates a lot of the mall space, has been declining. And then COVID hit.
She says the number of retailers that are looking to expand are few and far between. So Simon has had to look elsewhere to fill its vacant mall space. But for those other mall tenants, sharing space with Amazon might feel like an insult and won't bring in the foot traffic that they rely on. Enrique Becerra teaches marketing at Texas State University. He says the level of agitation will also depend on how much space Amazon would soak up.
If it's one of the anchors and you have, let's say, four anchors and only one of them becomes a distribution center, it may not be that big of a deal. But if you have more than one, then it becomes a deal.
He says Simon would be choosing the security of a steady tenant over getting customers to its malls. And any tenant is better than a yawning empty space. For Amazon, filling that mall space is about shortening the distance between where customers live and its warehouses. But Neil Saunders at Global Data Retail says even if a deal gets done, the change wouldn't be overnight.
It isn't just as simple as giving Amazon the space and then them moving in. There's a lot that needs to be done to convert this from retail to more of a fulfillment operation. And that isn't easy, and it isn't cheap either.
Simon didn't reply to a request for an interview. Amazon wouldn't comment. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here's your commercial aviation data point for this Monday. Almost 832,000 people passed through TSA checkpoints yesterday. That's a lot, especially in this coronavirus economy where just about every business that touches on air travel has been hit. Thing is, that 832,000 is way down from the more than 2.5 million people who flew a year ago yesterday. This has been all the most evident with airlines cutting back flights and getting ready to lay off tens of thousands of workers. But spare a thought, would you, for airports? We asked Marketplace's Erica Barris to check in.
Before the pandemic, the Missoula, Montana airport used to handle a couple thousand passengers a day. Then COVID hit. Chris Jensen is the airport director.
You could, you know, walk in and roll a bowling ball through the building and never hit anybody. It was really kind of surreal.
On its slowest day, only 40 passengers passed through the Missoula airport. Now it's back to about half the traffic it had before the pandemic. But that means it's still bringing in a lot less revenue from airline landing fees, passenger use fees, parking. Bob Mann is an industry analyst.
Every time you buy a meal at a terminal restaurant or a newspaper or a magazine at the newsstand or use a rental car, you're paying a fee to the airport.
The trouble is, we're doing a lot less of that these days.
You know, in a nutshell, it's a bloodbath.
And when it comes to stopping the bleeding, airports are pretty much on their own. Essentially, they're their own financial ecosystems. They generate their own revenue, and with a few exceptions,
revenues generated at the airport have to stay at the airport.
That's Janet Bednarik, the author of Airports, Cities, and the Jet Age. Some airports are trying to squeeze more revenue out of operations during the pandemic. At Orlando International Airport, CEO Phil Brown says that means handling different kinds of cargo.
We're looking at really trying to raise the game, if you will, for cargo to more high-value cargo that needs to be delivered quickly.
So, pharmaceuticals and personal protective equipment, for example, instead of packages for the Postal Service and FedEx. Missoula, Montana's airport took a different approach to weathering the downturn. Director Chris Jensen says it was all about cutting spending.
I don't believe there was a single point in our budget that wasn't impacted. So whether you're talking, you know, office supplies or personnel, we really went top to bottom, left to right, and cut every possible category.
At the end of the day, though, the only way airports are going to recover is if passenger aviation recovers. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
My stomach just kind of feels a little bit queasy and I tend to stiffen up.
Anxiety and your finances. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 357 today, 1.3%, 27,791. The NASDAQ, though, dropped 42 points, just under 0.4%, ended things at 10,968. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.2%, landed at 33.60. 3.6 million, that's how many gun background checks the FBI reports it processed last month. That's up 80% over July of last year. All of that by way of background for some news about Smith & Wesson Brands. The company is preparing to spin off its outdoor goods business from its firearms side in a couple of weeks. Shares in Smith & Wesson gained 1.4% of 1% today. Remember that $765 million loan that we reported Eastman Kodak was going to get from the federal government, sent shares skyrocketing? Well, since then, there have been allegations of security violations. A couple of law firms announced they may file suit. Today, the White House put the kibosh on that loan. Shares in Kodak, underdeveloped today. Get it? Underdeveloped. Almost 28%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The National Science Foundation provides funding for everything from technology for weather prediction to preschool education, and most recently, more than $100 million for coronavirus research. Rita Colwell, she is a microbiologist. She was the first female director of the NSF. She's also a professor at the University of Maryland and at Johns Hopkins as well. Her new book, it's a memoir, is called A Lab of One's Own, One Woman's Personal Journey Through Sexism in Science. Dr. Colwell, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here, Kai.
You've been around science for a while, we'll just say. And I'm curious, as we get going, what prompted you to want to write this book in this moment?
I started out to write the book about my work on cholera, but it morphed into more a discussion of women in science. And then the problems of sexism, sexual harassment, and the impediment of women in science. And so I ended up writing a book that tells the story of my work on cholera, but also the information about what it's been like to go through a career during a time of, let's say, stronger sexism and harassment than today.
Yeah.
So
is that a garbage truck going by?
I'm located very near the hospital. And
that's fine. We'll just go with it. I mean, look, we're all making radio from our garage right now, so don't worry about it.
So
let me climb back in and ask a follow up. You actually, in your training, had to change the field of science you were interested in because, in essence, you were a woman, right?
Indeed, my very first inquiry about science was the department chairman at Purdue University when I was an undergraduate. I had been accepted to medical school. I was on my way, but I met a very handsome graduate student who was to be my husband for the next 62 years. And I went to the department chairman asking for a fellowship where I would do a master's degree while Jack finished a master's. And then we'd go on together to another university where I would do medicine and he would do physics. But the chairman simply said, oh, we don't waste fellowships on women. So that was the first sort of slapdown, if you will.
When you look back on this, and we have to say you have had an amazing career, deeply fulfilling, I'm sure. You've done important, relevant work and run a major scientific institution in this government. But when you look back 50 years on, does it still make you angry? How do you feel about it?
No, not really angry. It energizes me now to make sure that my daughters and my granddaughter particularly will not have to go through this. My granddaughter wishes to do a career in neuroscience, and I would like to make sure that she and all of the other young girls who are planning to do a degree in science, engineering, or mathematics, or medicine, would have the opportunity to pursue their careers without impediments.
How old's your granddaughter?
She's 18.
Oh, so it's time. She's right there.
Yes, heading off to Smith College.
Given your experience and your daughter's experience in science, are you hopeful for your granddaughter's experience?
Oh, indeed I am. In fact, I'm hopeful for science because right now we have tremendous female talent working to produce a vaccine against COVID-19, just as one example, but also working in space science, physics, medicine. It's a very exciting time. And when you have 100% of the population involved, it's a whole lot better than just 50%.
Right. It's a book by Rita Colwell called A Lab of One's Own, One Woman's Personal Journey Through Sexism in Science. It's quite a read. Dr. Colwell, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kai.
We've got an excerpt from Dr. Colwell's book. It's a bit about what Title IX, most commonly cited, as you know, with female athletes in college, what it did for women in academia. It's over at marketplace.org. There are, according to professionals who study this kind of thing, there are four main ways that people relate to money. There's money vigilance, a need to always be saving. Money status, measuring your self-worth in money. Money worship, which makes you overvalue money. And money avoidance, fear or discomfort with spending. Marketplace's Peter Balanon-Rosen, a producer for our podcast This Is Uncomfortable, has this story of one man trying to overcome his money anxiety.
You need to know two things about Leonard Hyman. One, looking through his finances makes him so anxious his stomach hurts. And two,
I am a auditor for a local government.
Yeah, so other people's finances, no problem. But looking at his own sets off this whole physical chain reaction.
My stomach just kind of feels a little bit queasy, and
I tend to stiffen up. And then there's also just this element of just judgment of like, you know, why did you spend that money?
Leonard judges himself a lot. He second-guesses emails he sends to his boss, he'll obsess over a dumb joke he made at dinner, and he'll journal about those times, and then later judge those journal entries. So when it comes to his spending, he's learned the best way to avoid that self-judgment is to just not acknowledge it.
Like, I've set all of my credit cards to automatically deduct from my checking account so that I don't have to check them.
Leonard's lucky he makes enough money that he doesn't really have to worry. He actually did set up a budget tracker app to keep tabs on his spending. He just can't bring himself to look at it.
I'm scared to see, like, that I've overspent on stuff. Like, did I need it? Did I really? I'm definitely not confident that I have always made the right spending choices.
In exposure therapy, you're exposed to the thing that gives you anxiety, but without the actual negative outcome that comes with it.
Monica Tew is a PhD student at Columbia University. She studies the brain and why some events can be so emotional, like when Leonard looks at his finances. She offered a few tips to get through money-related anxiety. So there's exposure therapy, facing your problem head-on till it feels better. Also, distraction. Like, if Leonard were to glance through recent purchases in an Uber, he could focus on the outside world when those anxious feelings bubble up.
Maybe to then, like, break that circuit and hopefully stop the anxiety from really getting its claws into him.
A third tip, pair what makes you anxious with something that feels good. Like if Leonard's fiance holds his hand when he checks his bank account.
Then you have this other cue that every time I check my bank account, I'm with this person, I'm in this context that tells me that I'm going to be safe.
So I had Leonard try all three of Monica's tips. We spent an afternoon doing my version of exposure therapy, telling strangers over and over about his recent purchases, like the $175 he spent on a pair of tickets for a Broadway play.
Well, do you have any advice about how to be more confident in my spending choices?
If you're happy in the time that you use it, that is good. Be like, it's all fine and you'll be fine. You can do it.
I just think once you've got it, you've got it. There's no point in looking back.
Wise words. There was a trivia game to keep Leonard distracted while talking about things like how often he'd look through his finances before the wedding to his fiance, Jason.
Every other weekend.
I really love Jason's optimism. Before the wedding, the correct answer is 2 times.
Then, with his fiancée at his side, he actually mustered up the courage to look over his purchases from last year, including how many times he ordered something from Amazon.
209!
Oh, God.
Oh, man, I underestimated.
209 Amazon purchases. Yeah. But looking at his finances worked, at least for the moment.
Right now, I'm actually remarkably zen. I did not get the same nausea and anxiety that I normally do doing this.
That anxiety, it isn't actually about the money itself. It's about all the feelings we attach to money. Feelings which might just make your stomach hurt. I'm Peter Ballin on Rosen for Marketplace.
Our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, has Leonard's whole journey to check his finances, talking to Jeopardy winners, and riding swan boats along the way. Check it out. This final note on the way out today, as K-12 schools start getting back into session. Notice I said back into session, not opening, because a lot of them aren't. But districts that are opening physically, it's going to be expensive. The average school district, and this is from the Association of School Business Officials and the School Superintendents Association, the average school district is going to pay almost $1.8 million extra. That's for PPE and extra staff to do the cleaning, which is not, it should be noted here, money being spent on books and academic supplies. Okay, we are going, but not without your moment of economic context on this Monday. It comes courtesy of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They do a monthly survey on consumer expectations. Consumers, as we say here, all the time being critical to the health of this economy. Anyway, we were, says the New York Fed, a tad less hopeful in July than we'd been in May and June. Specifically, we're not thrilled with our job prospects and our personal financial situations the rest of this year. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin and Ali Pham, Maria Honhorst and Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.